You are listening to Accents, a radio show for literature, art and culture. I'm your host and producer, Katerina Stoikova-Klemer. Our guest today is nonfiction writer Neil Chetik. Hi Neil, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, Katerina.
Let me tell you a few words about our guest. Neil Chetik is speaker, author and expert specializing in men's lives and family issues. He is the author of two acclaimed books, Voicemail, What Husbands Really Think About Their Marriages, Their Wives, Sex, Housework and Commitment by Simon & Schuster in 2006, and Father Loss, How Sons of All Ages Come to Terms with the Deaths of Their Dads by Hyperion 2001. Previously, Neil was a staff reporter for the Tallahassee Democrat and San Jose Mercury News and writer of Voicemail, the first syndicated column on men's personal lives. His writings have appeared in hundreds of print and web publications. He is currently writer in residence at the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning in Lexington, Kentucky, where he lives with his wife, Kelly Flood, and their son, Evan. Hi, Neil. Could you please tell the listeners of Accents about your book, Father Loss?
Sure. Father Loss is a book about how sons deal with the deaths of their fathers. And it actually came to me. In fact, I hope later to read a section out of it that explains a little bit about when and how I came to write about it. But I started in the late 80s, writing about men's lives. And as I began to write more and more about that, I saw that the father and son relationship was a very powerful and understudied relationship. So I came from a journalism background and decided to go and interview about, 5 or 6 dozen men and ask them about their relationships with their fathers, and then particularly look at how their relationships went when their father died, how it was in the period just before their father's death, and then during the dying period, and then finally the death and the aftermath of it. So that's what I focus on, but it's really a book about how fathers and sons get along.
Thank you, Neil. My next question was going to be, how did you come up with the idea for the book? And you said that you had a quote from the book or a section.
Yes. Well,
would you like to go ahead and
read that quote right now, or that section. It's several paragraphs, but it tells a little bit about how I got interested in it. My own interest in father loss began 16 years ago with the most memorable words my father ever said to me. I was 27 years old at the time, between journalism jobs, living just a few blocks from the small Miami Beach apartment my paternal grandfather had set up after his retirement. It was the first time in my life that Grandpa was close by, and along with meals of pot roast and potatoes, I soaked up the stories of his harrowing childhood in Eastern Europe, desperate emigration, and eclectic life experiences spanning the 20th century. Then one day I got a phone call from a doctor. The voice said, "I'm sorry to tell you this, but your grandfather has had a heart attack and he has expired." The next day, my father flew to South Florida from his home in Michigan, and I picked him up at the airport and we drove in silence to the hospital to identify my grandpa's body, collect his watch and wallet, and make arrangements to ship the body north for burial at my grandmother's side. Then my father turned the key to my grandfather's home and we began sorting the material remnants of the old man's life. We discovered curled black and white photos from the early years, as well as keychains, checkbooks, matchbooks, coins, coupons, and a pack of stale generic cigarettes. Working in different rooms, we'd occasionally exclaim to each other about a special find. Mostly, my father and I sorted in silence. We kept at it until the glow of the afternoon sun had waned. Then my father and I collapsed in my grandfather's heavily pillowed living room chairs, glasses of the old man's scotch in hand. We shared memories for a while and then grew quiet. Finally, as the room faded into near total darkness, I heard a guttural groan. At first, I was startled, and then I realized what was happening. I had never before heard my father cry. I rose and went to Neil by his side. After a few minutes, he spoke. He said, "I'm crying not only for my father, but for me. His death means I'll never hear the words I've always wanted to hear from him, that he was proud of me, proud of the family I'd raised and the life I've lived." My father then directed his voice toward me, and he uttered the words that continued to resound. "So that you never have to feel this way too," he said to me, "I want to tell you now how proud I am of you, of the choices you've made, of the life you've created."
Thank you, Neil. This is absolutely beautiful. For the listeners of Accent, you just heard an excerpt from Father Law's Neil Chetik's book, and he's with us in the studio. Neil, how is this book structured? It has a very interesting structure, I would like to.
Yes. You know, I think as a writer, especially of books, structure, probably the same thing with poetry, but structure is always one of the most difficult parts of it. People think, you know, I'll just start writing and, you know, it'll go from one part to the next kind of automatically. And I suppose there are people who are lucky enough to have that happen. But I work very hard to find a structure for it. And what I eventually did was I came up with a structure that started with the impact of father loss, and it broke it down by the age at the time of the death, because the age of the child at the time of the death, whether the child is 6 years old or 26 years old or 56 years old, has the biggest impact on how he's going to react to it. You know, a child will be torn apart, whereas a middle-aged person may not have as much of a complicated reaction to it. On the other hand, in middle life, when our fathers die, we tend to think, well, I'm going to be next. So we have a different reaction to it. And then the second part was the way, what I wrote about was the way that men tend to grieve and how we grieve differently than women do, or than the norm says. Men don't cry as much as women do during the grieving process, and we don't necessarily want to talk about it as much. But we tend to be more active and more intellectual about it. We think about things more than we talk about them, and we act more than we cry. And then one other thing that you may have also been speaking about is I took about 10 stories of famous men through the years and found out through reading their biographies where, what point their fathers died and what impact that had on their particular lives. And I found that in almost every case, from Michael Jordan to the president, John Quincy Adams, to Gandhi, the death of the father had a major impact on changing the lives of the sons at the time of the death and beyond that. So that's kind of how I structured those little stories with chapters, and focusing on the ages of father loss and the rebounding from father loss.
And also the book ends with an extensive set of appendices with important resources. Mm-hmm. Could you please tell the listeners of Accents what kind of information is included there?
Sure. Certainly I mentioned all the sources when it came to articles and other books that have been written on it. But I also gave a list of movies that were related to fathers and sons, and there's some wonderful movies in there. In fact, since then, I've kept an ongoing list of movies in order to, you know, keep up with whatever's latest. And also a lot of resources that are related to loss issues and also men's issues. It's harder to keep up with those because the web is just exploding every year, and my book came out a few years ago, so some of those aren't as recent. But anyone who would like to find out the latest on those kinds of things can go to my website, and one of the addresses is fatherloss.com. That's the easiest address, fatherloss1word.com.
Neil, who should read this book? Who is this book intended for?
The book is intended, you know, my father was still alive and is still alive, but was still alive when I started writing it. I do remember the day that I called him and said to him, you know, how would you feel if I wrote a book about how men deal with the deaths of their fathers? Fortunately, he's a psychologist. So the first thing he said was, oh, I would love that book because I have men who come to me as a psychologist and they would need that book. So my father's been offering that book to his clients ever since I wrote it, which is a special thing. But mostly I think it's good for people who are either looking forward, as in looking ahead, and noting that their fathers are either ill or aging, and they are a little concerned themselves with how are they going to react to it. The book is not a here's what you should do book or a how-to book. It's a book of stories about men who have experienced the loss of a father. So you would gain from reading it and comparing your own story to the stories of these other men. And for me, as someone who hadn't lost their father, it's sort of taken the unknown out of it a little bit, you know, so it's not this something going to happen, but I don't even want to think about it. It allowed me to think about it. The other time is right at or just before the death is a time where the book tells some stories about things that you can do in the few weeks or months before your father dies that can help you so that after the death, you are not regretting things that you didn't do. It really urges you to do what you should do, say what you want to say, you know, be there with him if at all possible. And then, of course, people who are afterwards have, you know, experienced the death, you know, and are struggling with it in some way or another. This will help you realize that you're probably not alone. There is one other chapter in there that is specifically for women in the lives of men who have lost a father. That could be a wife, say, of a man who's lost his father, or the mother of a son who has lost his father. Trying to understand men as they go through the grieving process, it can help. That's what I wrote that chapter for. So I like it for men who are dealing with any loss before, during, or after, and women who want to support those men.
And how is the book being accepted by the audience?
This book has been amazing to me. It's now coming up on 10 years since it came out, and it continues to sell pretty robustly every year. Not like I make a living off of it, but it continues to sell in the thousands of copies per year. So, and I don't really have to do anything. It's kind of gotten around word of mouth. Part of that is because there was no other book like it when it was written. There's been a couple others that are somewhat similar, but for the most part, it's unique. For some reason, and I got a lot of turndowns from people who said, it's a good idea, but men won't buy this book. So it's just typical that they think, well, men, they don't really think about these things, or they don't care about these things, or they don't want to talk about them. But in fact, not only did they talk to me about them, but they actually want to read them. And I get letters all the time. I've saved all of them, too. There's like several hundred readers have written me letters telling me what they've read, their own stories. Sometimes they'll just say, I just finished reading your book, and I just want to tell you what my situation is and was. And they would just write me, you know, six paragraphs on whatever that situation.
That's amazing.
Yeah. That's wonderful. Amazing. So I feel very, you know, I feel like that in some ways was my life's work. I hope I have more things, you know, but as far as a writer, this was something that I feel tapped me for all that I was, you know, all that I could offer at the time. And I did my best with it, and it was received in that way.
The book starts with a gypsy proverb. You have to dig deep to bury your father, which I found poignant, true, and also a perfect way to start the book. Mm. Neil, where did you encounter this quote, and did you know right away that you wanted to include it in the book?
I would have to look back to figure out where I ran into it. I you can see it's a gypsy proverb, so it's not attached to any particular person. But I remember after seeing it, immediately realizing that it was the right quote, because it has so many levels. You have to dig deep to bury your father. You know, the obvious two levels of you do have to literally dig deep to bury anyone, but then you also have to dig deep within yourself to bury your father or to move on from the loss of your father. So what I realized with that quote was about was just about how we have to do work when we are letting go of those who, you know, our fathers, our mothers, our ancestors, people we know and who die. You have to do some work on letting go. You have to do some grief work, and sometimes you have to do some relationship work. And as you were mentioning, sometimes the work happens before they die, but the digging is easier usually if you start the digging before the death, because then you can have the conversations you might want to have with your loved one. You might say whatever it is to say. Otherwise, the ground is pretty hard when you're starting the digging right at the death. Then you've got to do it all on your own. So that's one of the things that I, you know, have definitely learned. Always look for a way to connect with my father right now. Look for a way to connect with my mother, with my siblings, with aunts and uncles, and make sure that I don't leave unfinished business.
That's a wonderful message. You are listening to Accents, a radio show for literature, art, and culture. I'm your host and producer, Katerina Stoikova-Klemmer. Our guest today is nonfiction writer Neil Chetik. Neil, you are also the author of a book titled Voicemail, with the subtitle What Husbands Really Think About Their Marriages, Their Wives, Sex, Housework, and Commitment. So, what do husbands really think?
Well, they like marriage. A lot of people think, when you first start thinking about men and marriage, that, well, men don't want to talk about it, and men don't really necessarily think that much about it. They're just sort of in it or they're not in it. But what I found similarly to the research that I did for Father Loss was that if you are respectful of men and respectful of the way men tend to communicate, that they will talk about just about anything. And so, you know, one of the ways that men talk about things, they tend, if I sat down and asked them, how do you feel about something, or what's your emotions about something, I would often not get much out of them. But if I asked them to tell me the story, when was the first time you ever met the woman who you are now married to? Then it was more of a factual thing. The emotions that they had would come out. They would describe, oh, I thought she was beautiful, or you know, she swept me off my feet, or she looked ordinary, but after a moment there was something about her, or whatever. The story comes out. So I found that in interviewing men, I could get them to talk if I just asked them to tell me the story. And so I sat down again with another 60 or 70 men and asked them the story from the first time they met the woman they would marry until the present day. All of them were married to those women at the time that I interviewed them. So, you know, I mostly talked with men who were happy enough in their marriages to at least still be in their marriages. And what they told me was that they like being married. They have a lot of frustrations in the marriages, but few that are so great that they would want to be out of their marriages.
I was wondering if you worked with your dad on that book, since he's a psychologist, right?
Yes. I didn't work with him too much on this one. I worked more with my wife on this one. But really, you know, my father is helpful. He's not a marriage counselor. He is himself married now 56 years.
Wow.
Yes. So he had some interesting stories to tell me. And he did actually share his story for the book. But I didn't go to him quite as much on the marriage as I did on the father-son book, because that was really very much about the two of us.
And how was your wife helpful in the writing of this book?
Well, I had to ask her all the stories that I would tell that involved our marriage. I had to ask her if it was okay if I would tell those stories. But she is a minister, so she has stood in front of many audiences and her congregation when she was a parish minister and talked about our lives. So in some ways, our lives have always been a little bit more public than most people's lives. And we spent about a year, several years ago, doing workshops at various churches around the country on marriage. So we had done a lot of work with each other already in the marriage realm. So she was very, very helpful.
Can we please hear an excerpt from voicemail?
Yes. And in fact, this is an excerpt that does speak about my own personal experience with marriage. Born in the center of the post-war baby boom, I was born in 1957. I am, in matters of marriage, a member of the straddle generation. One of my feet is planted in the era of Father Knows Best. My parents married in 1953, just days after graduating from college. My father's military service, education, and career choices dictated my parents' travels in their early years together. When their kids were young, my father made the money, my mother the meals. He left home each morning, she stayed home all day. Thus, I got a taste of the traditional American family that in some circles is so lovingly remembered today. But as I came of age in the late 1960s and early 70s, I found myself stepping into a fresh feminist world. My mother returned to graduate school, then she launched a professional career. My female classmates in high school and college competed with me for grades and jobs. It was in the echo of this era that I met my wife, Kelly. We crossed paths on the job in 1983 when we were both in our mid-20s. Our differences in personality and sexuality and family background made for a tumultuous courtship. But I was attracted to her luminous smile and optimism, and something told us not to give up. Finally, after 4 years of struggle, we pledged ourselves to each other for life. And then our troubles really began. I remember a particularly rude awakening in the first year of our marriage. The bedside clock blazed 3:02 a.m., but it was Kelly who was in a state of alarm. Pushing at my shoulder, she said, "We've got to talk right now." I extracted myself from the arms of sleep and rolled to face her. It was the third night in a row she'd awakened me this way. As before, she was sitting back against the headboard, sheet pulled to her waist. "I realize now," she said, "that we have to get divorced." And then she concluded, "The sooner the better." I have never been a morning person, but I tried nonetheless to catch on to the rhythm of this conversation. "Yes, we're having problems," I thought to myself. Finances were tight, we hadn't had sex for several weeks, and worst of all, I wasn't meeting her standards of affection. Cuddling, hand-holding, and little nothings, it turned out, did not come readily from me. Despite my haze, I knew that my response in that bed would be momentous, and so I paused before I launched. And then I said, "It may be so. It may be that we've made a huge mistake. It may be that our life together is over. But..." And here's where I got to the crux of my response. "I'm not going to talk about it right now. I'm not going to talk about something this important in the middle of the night." And then I dove back into the mattress and fell asleep. 18 years of marriage later, Kelly and I can look back and smile on that moment. Since that wake-up call, we've grappled with our physical needs and spending habits and household chores and a laundry list of other differences and disagreements. Some of these issues could actually be labeled as solved. The great majority of them have resulted in hopeful accommodations, wobbly compromises, and agreements to disagree. And yet, buoyed by my research on this book, I've learned to trust those compromises, to celebrate those temporary agreements. They're really all a married couple has. While marriage may be a venerable institution with a history many thousands of years old, each bond is fragile.
Thank you, Neil. And for the listeners of Accents, you just heard excerpt from Voicemail, a nonfiction title by Neil Chetik. Neil, where can the listeners of Accents find copies of your book?
both of the books are available through your local bookstore, certainly on Amazon.com and at my website. And I mentioned it earlier, fatherloss.com, or my name, which is very hard to spell, but it's Neil, N-E-I-L, Chethick, C-H-E-T, as in Tom, H-I-K, neilchethick.com. But if you look under Father Loss, you usually can find your way to me much easier.
Thank you, Neil. Some of your audience is women. Mm-hmm. For example, you give talks on how to get your men to talk for women only. Could you please share a few insights for our female listeners?
Mm-hmm. Well, I alluded to it earlier about how to get men to talk. And I think one of the key things is to remember that men grew up in a different culture, really, than women do when it comes to communicating. That men's communication, if you think about it, men are often communicating through sports or physical activity. So if you think about a basketball team, men tend to be on the same team, going in the same direction with a goal that they're trying to reach. And their communication with each other isn't verbal, but it's more visual or spatial. So one of the things that I've learned over time is that talking with men is often easier if you're side by side with them, or at least not face to face, because face to face for men in the male culture tends to be either confrontive or it can be sexual. But if you're wanting to just have a conversation with a man, if you kind of are looking cross ways to him, you can...
Or take a walk together?
Yes, taking a walk together. A lot of the men said that some of their best conversations came when they were driving in a car. And they weren't like looking deeply into each other's eyes, but they were close enough so that, you know, the conversation could kind of take its own course. Another way that men like to communicate is if you're doing something like a project at your home. Men said they talked with wives and felt close to their wives when they were, say, working in their backyard on, you know, plantings in the spring, or raking leaves together, or if they were working on a project in the house where they were painting in the same room or doing something, some kind of house project. That way, again, there was like the men were busy with their hands and busy doing things, which somehow makes it freer for men to sort of open up other parts of their communication. So, you know, the sit down face to face, now we're going to talk type of situation is a little intimidating for men, maybe intimidating for women too, but it's a particularly intimidating for men. That men often feel like we're being like lectured by our mothers. You know, what did we not do right? you know, we're afraid of that situation. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is to, rather than asking, so how do you feel, trying to stick with more of the story, trying to get him to tell what happened. So the phrases like, you know, tell me what happened, and then what happened next, and then how did you react, as opposed to how did you feel? How did you react, or what did you think, or what did you do? So it's a little bit of a language thing as well as a positioning, physical positioning. If you keep those things in mind, you know, it doesn't have to happen all the time, and men should be capable of speaking about their personal lives and their emotional lives too. But if you're trying to reach out to men and sort of capture them where they are, you probably will be more successful if you spend some time side by side doing things and ask them to tell you what happened, not tell you about their emotions.
Thank you, Neil. I found that most useful, and I hope that our female listeners were taking notes. Another talk that you have been known to give is 4 steps to love in the long run. Can you give us at least one of those steps?
At least one of those steps? 4 steps of love for the long run. Yeah, I think one of those steps has to do with, if you want a relationship to last for the long run, then it helps, we found, to think about where you want to be in 10 years or 20 years. But even more so, think about where your partner may want to be in 10 years or 20 years. So having the conversation where you're dreaming, is telling your dreams and your partner is telling her dreams, his dreams, you then can work toward helping your partner reach their dreams. It seems like, you know, my wife and I have spent, for the most part, our long-term dreams are somewhat similar. We both love the world, so we want to travel when we can in the world, when we're still healthy, and we love food, so we want to go eat our way around the world. And one of the things we did was we created a fund for ourselves where we put extra, if someone makes an extra couple $100 doing something or whatever, we put it in that fund that is our Eat Our Way Around the World fund. Now, when you're partners and you're doing that and you have this sort of joint dream together, it's harder to split up or to imagine yourself splitting up. You'd have to, like, you know, not take that trip that you've always wanted to take. So I suggest to couples, no matter where they are in their lifetimes, to think of where they would like to be in 5, 10, 15 years. Tell your partner that and try to figure out a way where you two together can make both of your dreams come true.
Neil, the main theme of your writing and speaking engagements is men's life and family issues. How did you decide, or why did you feel compelled to specialize in this area?
Well, I look back on it now, because it's probably been about 20 plus years since I started writing about men's issues. And there are two things really that brought me in this direction. One was that I'm a journalist. And as a journalist, my training was get the stories that are most interesting and that no one else has been writing about. And when I started writing about men's issues in 1989, 1990, there was virtually nobody writing about it. It was in the decade or two after the women's movement had come on strong and changes in the U.S. especially, but maybe around the world as well, changes in the dynamics between men and women were happening because women were no longer saying, I'm going to stay at home and be a housewife and not work and take care of the children and depend on the man. Well, the men weren't the first ones to say that we want these big changes, but we had to respond to them. And if we were going to be in relationships with women and if we were going to be in the workplace, because there were women there. So I saw a big story developing really in American life, was that gender and men and women's relationships were going to change. But so far, nobody was writing about what men were doing. And at that time, men were sort of reacting and running scared and trying to figure it out and, you know, doing some more crazy things to respond to it, try to stop women or push them back. And, you know, that wasn't working, and nor was it, in my mind, very helpful. So that was one reason, is I saw a major story happening and I thought I would like to write about this story. It interested me. And that's the other side of it, is what interested me. For me, relationships, I mean, growing up with a father who is a psychologist, and that, you know, made me think about psychology and relationships. So that I just had kind of almost an innate interest in that. But also, I think the changes that were happening, like my father's generation was that stoic, not really show your emotions. When I saw my father cry that time when his father died, that was my first time. I was 27 years old at that time. So it was typical of my father's generation to never show emotion, to never speak about it. So what happened to me was I realized that I didn't want to go through my whole life like that. So I had a lot of personal interest in how men were changing. And then I saw this story, this, you know, cultural change that was happening that I wanted to write about. So the two of those came together and I ended up writing a lot of personal stuff. Like I write about my son, my relationship with my son, my relationship with my father, my relationship with my wife. All that was personal. But then I kind of added the journalistic side of it, where I'd interview a lot of people and And for both of my books, I brought it even to the social science part where I did surveys with universities so that I would have hard numbers and it wouldn't just be a here's what I think type book, but a, here's some factual data as well. So for me, it's just been a combination of personal and professional that fortunately came together and something that even now keeps me somewhat interested.
In previous conversations with you, I became aware that you are involved with an organization called the Mankind Project. Could you please tell the listeners of Accents about the mission of this organization?
Yeah. Well, the Mankind Project, and it's you can find it on the web at MKP, as in project, .org. And I would suggest anyone who really wants to know more about it go there, because while I have been through some of their programs, I'm not an organizer or anything of it. But I found it very helpful because it was an organization where men could get together with other men and find and, you know, discuss issues that were of interest, particularly to men, and to have other men mentor them in growing as a man. So it's kind of a personal growth organization in which men help each other become more grounded as men and become better men. I know later you're going to ask me about my book of the week. I would this be jumping the gun if I said something about that right now?
No, go ahead.
Okay, because it's a segue from this in that there's a new organization that I found out about not long ago called the Good Men Project. And the book that I want to suggest was a book called The Good Men Project. And it's under subtitled Real Stories from the Front Lines of Modern Manhood. And it's a book that includes 31 essays by men of all different ages and backgrounds and rich and poor, black, white, gay, straight, urban and rural. And what each of them writes about is the challenges that they face as men and the struggles that they have. Because so much of what we have, it's not a chicken soup for the soul, which has sort of got a happy, you know, everything's happy and ties up in a neat bow. These are men who are really in struggle or in challenge, you know, facing the challenges of their lives as men and then writing about those challenges. So what is it like to be, you know, to deal with the death of a father? What is it like to try to raise a son in the world that we live in? What is it like to be in relationship with a woman who, you know, is feminist? What are the challenges when we grew up in a society where women weren't? So each of these, and there's some that are about being in low-income situations where drugs was the way you would make money selling drugs, and they ended up in prison. And so how do you deal with prison situations? And what I really like about this book is that all the stories are well-written, and they're all complicated. They're all, none of them is, here's the easy answer. They're all stories that examine what it's like to be a man in America today and to be a man facing a complicated world.
And that's nonfiction too, right?
It's also nonfiction, The Good Men Project. And it's available at goodmenbook.com, goodmenbook.com. And all of the proceeds from this goes to organizations that are helpful to boys who are at risk. So there's a lot of Big Brother organizations and others where we can get mentors to boys who don't have men in their lives. It's a very new organization, and I'm not involved with it except as somebody who was sent copies of the book and asked if I would support it if I thought it was of value, and I found it to be a valuable organization.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you very much, Neil. This was our notable book of the week, The Good Men Project. And can you repeat again, who is the editor of that book?
There's three editors, James Houghton, Larry Bean, that's B-E-A-N, like a lima bean, and Tom Matlack, M as in Mary, A T as in Tom, L A C K, Matlack. And like I say, those three men are working to bring together and to try to start a conversation is what it means to be a good man in 21st century, this world really in 21st century.
Thank you, Neil. And now for a completely different part of our conversation, you serve as the writer in residence at the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning in Lexington, Kentucky. What are some of the duties that you perform at this wonderful, wonderful place? I'm a big fan of the Carnegie Center.
Yes, the Carnegie Center is one of the rare places, especially in cities of the size of Lexington, Kentucky, where all kinds of writing training is available. Usually it's the bigger cities like San Francisco and New York and Chicago that can support that. But our Kentucky has a rich literary history and tradition that continues to this day, and there's a great support for Kentucky writers. As the writer in residence there, I have basically two duties. One is to teach classes, and I focus on teaching nonfiction writing classes. So people who are interested in writing books in the nonfiction arena, I teach classes that help them or get published even in article form or newspapers or online where they're doing nonfiction. I help them do that. And I also work one-on-one with students. So I have several people who have written entire books, and now they want to edit it or make it available, get it into print. Sometimes that means trying to reach out to the publishing world that's traditional out there, and sometimes it means publishing it themselves and then figuring out how to market it and all that kind of stuff. So I work with people who are trying to market or either write books or articles, market those so that they can be sent out, you know, and maybe paid for them, people paid for them. And then I also help to, at the center, help to create a programming for us that includes fiction writing, poetry writing. In fact, we want to definitely have you to teach some of our poetry writing classes there. How to write poetry. Can we sign you up for that?
Absolutely. I would love to.
Okay. And we have all kinds of different writing classes. Sometimes they're broad, like, you know, poetry 101, and sometimes they're very specific, like, you know, how do you market a poetry book, or how do you create characters or dialogue in your fiction writing book? And we have published writers at all levels teaching those kind of classes.
And what are some upcoming events hosted by the Carnegie Center?
I'll tell you this. Carnegie Literacy, that's Carnegie Literacy, LITERACY.org, is where we have all of our programming. We are just getting our winter schedule, winter 2010 schedule, up, and it will be available shortly. But I know that we include a nonfiction writing group that I'm leading, and I'm also teaching a class, a Saturday morning 2-hour seminar on the basics of creative nonfiction. How do we take nonfiction, you know, facts and quotes and that kind of thing, and make it really interesting and readable? How do we go from the boring nonfiction that we often think of to exciting page-turning nonfiction? And that, I'm going to teach a little bit on that. We also, I know, have fiction writing master classes for people who are writing fiction and would like to finish a novel or write a novel from the very beginning to the end. So we sort of show, we have fiction writers, people like Lynn Pruitt, who has got a wonderful fiction book out, and Crystal Wilkinson, who's got a couple of short story books out, who teach on our behalf. And the specifics of those are still in the works, but they should be ready within the next couple of weeks and available online. Our brochure should be online.
We already spoke about a notable book of the week, and I have two more questions for you about the two rubrics that I ask all of my guests to be prepared to talk about. One of them is literary term of the week. Neil, do you have a literary term that you would like to teach our listeners?
Yes, a favorite one of mine, I seem to bring it up a lot with my students, is a term called the nut graph. Nut graph. And it's mostly used in journalism and most frequently with feature articles as opposed to newsy type things, but feature articles. And the nut graph is the paragraph that usually is about three or four paragraphs from the beginning, and sometimes it can be a little later in an article, and it explains the gist of the article. So if you cut away all the rest of the article, the nut graph would be sort of that central paragraph that you could tell by reading it what the basics of the article was about. It explains what the story is about, but it doesn't give you all the information. It just gives you enough so that you know where you're going, and it sort of serves to compel you to keep reading as well. So it's a very important paragraph, and maybe the most important paragraph in an article. I could give you an example if
Absolutely.
We have time.
Please.
Okay. A few years ago, I got to watch a heart bypass operation standing next to the heart surgeon as he explained to me everything that he was doing. It was very exciting, and I learned quite a bit, and I got to make it through the early part, which was not... They took bets that I would be the one who would collapse in there. But once they open up the chest of somebody and they sort of cover the face and the legs and the arms and everything, and all you've got is this open chest, some of that other stuff goes away. I want to read you the opening lines or the opening couple of paragraphs, and then I'll alert you when I've gotten to the nut graph.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you.
Clyde Sargent's heart lies still in his wide open chest, a pale pink softball-sized organ ready to power his body once again. The surgeon takes the handles of two electric paddles. They look like spatulas. He cradles the motionless organ between them and makes the call. "Ready, go," he says, and a jolt of electricity sends the heart into a quivering spasm. Like a cold engine, though, the heart sputters and stalls. Eyes unblinking above his surgical mask, the doctor sets down the paddles, shifts the fleshy organ with his rubber-gloved hands, pauses, and prepares for a second try. That's the lead of the article, but you really don't know all that much about it. The next paragraph is the nut graph. This is the climactic moment in what has become the most common heart operation in the nation. About 300,000 Americans, mostly men aged 50 to 70, will undergo a heart bypass operation this year, joining more than 2 million others who have done so since 1964. For the 98% of patients who survive the operation, the results often seem miraculous. People who wouldn't walk a block suddenly walk a mile. People who suffered wrenching chest pains suddenly feel no pain, and people who were days or hours from death suddenly find years of life ahead of them. So that is the nut graph, which takes the anecdote from the very beginning and tries to put it into context, into what's going to happen. It doesn't tell you everything, and of course the lead was there to try to draw you in and make you wonder whether or not this guy was going to live or die. We still... by the all accounts, don't know yet whether he's going to survive this. And then the nut graph starts to back you up and tell you what the whole article is going to be about. So that's a nut graph.
That is wonderful. Nut graph, everyone. And my last question is, who is the foreign poet of the week?
My foreign poet of the week is Kabir. And this was a writer from around the 15th century, lived in what's now North India. And I failed to write down what language he wrote in, but I've got an English translation done by the poet, American poet, Robert Bly. And one thing that I love about Kabir's writings is that he teaches spirituality, but not as an external relationship with an external God, but as an inward devotion to certain principles. And I thought this one, this poem, was a particularly powerful example of that. It's called To Be a Slave of Intensity. Friend, hope for the guest while you are alive. Jump into experience while you are alive. Think and think while you are alive. What you call salvation belongs to the time before death. If you don't break your ropes while you're alive, do you think ghosts will do it after? The idea that the soul will join with the ecstatic just because the body is rotten, that is all fantasy. What is found now is found then. If you find nothing now in life, you will simply end up with an apartment in the city of death. If you make love with the divine now, in the next life, you will have the face of satisfied desire. So plunge into the truth. Find out who the teacher is. Believe in the great sound. Kabir says this: when the guest is being searched for, it is the intensity of the longing for the guest that does all the work. Look at me, and you will see a slave of that intensity.
Thank you. Thank you, Neil. Absolutely beautiful poem by Kabir, translated by Robert Bly. Thank you very much for a wonderful conversation, and I wish you best of luck with your writing and your work with the Carnegie Center.
Thank you very much for having me. I had a great time.